Welcome to the Combat Morale Podcast with me, your host, Dr. Tom Thorpe. The Combat Morale Podcast explores what motivates people to fight or not fight in armed conflict. A quick disclaimer before we get to the action. The views expressed by any of the guests on the podcast are purely of a personal nature, do not represent the views or opinions of any organisation or government. With that disclaimer out of the way.
And on today's podcast, I talk to author, historian and lecturer, Dr. Richard Baxell, about his research into British volunteers serving with the international brigades during the Spanish Civil War. This podcast has been recorded to complement Sean Scullion's podcast, broadcast next week, where we talk about Sean's new book on Spanish Republicans and their service in the British and French armies during the Second World War. Richard spoke to me from his home in England.
Richard, welcome to the podcast. Before we dive into this topic, could you give us a brief introduction about yourself and how you became involved in this fascinating subject?
Yes, I'm a historian, and I've been writing and researching about the International Brigades now for, well, I suppose it's coming on for 30 years. My initial interest in the subject was, I guess, much the same as many people in the UK. When I was a teenager, I read Homage to Catalonia. I was a bit of an Orwell buff when I was a teenager, and I loved the book, but I guess, like many other people, I found the two chapters which explained the politics behind the war and the various acronyms absolutely bewildering and baffling. So I kind of parked that for a number of years. And a few years later, I read For Whom the Bell Tolls, the famous Hemingway novel. And that had a very profound effect on me. I still can't quite explain why. But I think to some extent I associated with this idea of sacrifice and somebody, or rather I less associated, but more I found it really fascinating that someone would take this conscious decision to sacrifice themselves for a cause. I don't want to talk too much about the book and give away the ending, but suffice to say that, you know, like the war itself, it didn't end well. So that was really a kind of, that gave me a kind of personal, emotional contact to the war. So when I became a student, I was a mature student. And it was really all I wanted to study. I took a degree in history, wrote my dissertation on the coverage of the war in the British press. And when I moved on to do an MA, I designed a database to try and have a look at who the people were who went to Spain for the UK. And the particular question that I later wanted to answer as a PhD student was, why on earth would all these people travel to Spain to fight in the conflict? You know, most of them had never traveled abroad before. What was the connection? What were they doing? Now, the more I studied the PhD, the more I realized that in some respects, that's not that complicated a question. And we can return to that. And then I really broadened it out from there to just understand the wider nature of their experiences, both before, during, and after Spain. And my latest book is very much kind of looking at a number of individuals and putting, rather than talking about the volunteers in the war, it's really, if you like, talking about the war in the greater history of these people's lives. So seeing what role it played, why they went, and what happened to them afterwards.
So looking at what we're going to talk about today, could we start with some background? I've got three questions, which I think broadly we could probably take together. Firstly, how many Britons volunteered to serve in Spain? Who were they? I'm wondering whether I'm correct in assuming they're all left-wing poets and authors like Hemingway and Orwell that you mentioned before. And what proportion of these individuals were women?
There were about, I mean, it's difficult. It's, numbers is hugely problematic. For various reasons, people used nom de guerre. The whole notion of nationality, how do you define somebody from Britain? Were they born here? Were they born somewhere else? Particularly when you take into account people from Ireland, there were lots of immigrants from places like Cyprus. And then you've got all the volunteers from around the empire. In general, we use a working number of about 2,500, but there were probably slightly less than that, say 2,300, 2,400. In terms of their background, They were overwhelmingly working class. There was this notion up until a few years ago that very much as you were saying, that they were students, you know, people like Orwell, John Cornford, the great-grandson of Charles Darwin. And in a way, that's true, perhaps in the very start of the war, before the Communist International had begun recruiting people from, you know, various communist parties from around Britain and wider. But at first, it was very much people who had travelled before in general, possessed passports, so were able to travel, had experience of travel. But as I say, once the Comintern got involved at the end of 1936, that very much changed. And then by that stage, the people who went to Spain were overwhelmingly urban, working class, male, with very limited experience, as I say, of travel or indeed many things else. Anything else? About 70% were members of the Communist Party. There were women. Women did go to Spain. And in fact, the first British volunteer to die in Spain was a woman called Felicia Brown, who was a sculptor from Slade. And she was killed at the end of August while serving with a militia unit. But she was really, I mean, there were other women involved here and there. But in the main, the women that went to Spain worked within the medical services or as in various support ways, whether helping Basque children, the refugee children, or in various other support areas for the Republic. There's probably about 40 nurses, I would say, from the UK that went to Spain.
And what motivated these people to travel to Spain? It must have been quite a significant amount of money. There was obviously interest by the authorities. And what obviously motivations varied from individual to individual, but what sort of things could we generalise about these people?
Well, the most straightforward generalisation we can make without any doubt is that the people who went to Spain to fight fascism. As you say, why they went, the individuals wanted to fight fascism is more complicated. Most of the volunteers were members of the Communist Party, and it's also fair to say that that's not straightforward. There tends to be this idea that the members of the Communist Party at the time were a kind of homogenous block of Stalinists who were fully prepared to do whatever Stalin told them. And that was of course true of some. But a lot of the people who went to Spain had only joined the Communist Party in the 1930s, after the rise of Nazism, after the rise of Mosley in the UK. So they were really anti-fascist communists, if you like. And that's the one thing that united them. They'd seen fascism in the UK, they'd seen the rise of Nazism, fascism in Italy, and they were really. Spain was really the latest battlefield in a wider war against European fascism. And it was felt that if fascism could be defeated in Spain, then maybe it could be defeated in Europe. And perhaps we wouldn't need to go to have a kind of major conflict of a European or world war. And of course, you know, that is exactly what happened.
And did people have sort of other factors like escaping from a bad romance, escaping from debt, maybe going for the adventure of war?
Yeah, this was very much talked about at the time. And it was particularly an accusation thrown at the international brigades that they were either dupes or, you know, that they were being bribed, all sorts of things. And of course, for some people, there would have been. They would have been going there for adventure, or they were trying to escape situations at home. But this was very much, you know, the exception, really. And of course, in any, you know, if you've got 2,500 people, you're going to have a few people who have their own reasons for going. But I don't think it's a fair way of talking about the brigades because it's such an exception. And in the main, they were just, you know, they were just working class people. Left wing from around the British Isles, major cities, London, Glasgow, Manchester. So now I although you can talk about individuals maybe on occasions, I don't think that's a fair summary, really.
Turning to the political motivation, you said that 70% roughly members of the Communist Party. Did they have any sort of, I suppose, broad differences within that? The reason I asked about that is that, other interviews I've done have suggested that, obviously the political motivation sometimes got so eminent that they would fight each other, a bit like the, Judean People's Popular Front, etc. And that, the anarchist would fight the other anarchists, and that often the political motivations of many Republican soldiers was it was aiming at more ideological purity rather than fighting the nationalists. Would that be fair to say that of the British volunteers, or is that largely just a myth that I've got in my head?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because it taps. I think people particularly tend to focus in on this because the main route, as it was for me, into the Spanish Civil War and British involvement tends to be Orwell. And Orwell, of course, didn't fight with the Communist International Brigades. He served with a militia unit, a POOM militia unit, which was essentially an anti-Stalinist Communist Party. So they very much were, so they were against Stalin. Stalin very much persecuted those who were involved in the POOM. And anybody who's read Homage to Catalonia will know that during the May Days in Barcelona in May 1937, it erupted into violence. So it's absolutely true that there was sectarian and there was, if you like, a mini civil war within the civil war. I guess a lot of people will have seen the film Land and Freedom by Ken Loach, which very much makes a lot of this. And that's certainly true. There were huge differences of opinion, and it ended up with people on different sides of the barricade, if you like, in Barcelona in May 1937. And they, yeah, it was pretty brutal. Right, just pause for one sec. Let just me collect my thoughts. Yeah, so I think it's definitely true to say there were differences of political opinion between the British volunteers. There were a few people who were anarchists. There were a few Trotskyists, but the majority of them fought with the Communist International Brigades. Yeah, I think that's a fair summary.
So I know we're talking about really British volunteers who fight predominantly on the Republican side, the government side. Were there any individuals from Britain and maybe Ireland as well who served with Franco and the fascists and nationalists? And what motivated them to go? I know that's not totally our focus of what we're doing, but it's an interesting parallel to look at their motivation as well.
Yeah, there were no more than a handful from Britain who fought for Franco. The two most well known being Frank Thomas and Peter Kent, both who've written about their experiences. Both of those were, I think it's safe to say, would be driven by anti-communism, really. They were both very right wing, and they saw the Spanish Civil War as really they perceived it as Stalin wanting to take over another country. So they were very much anti-communist. But the largest group of people to fight for Franco from Britain and Ireland were about 600 Irish who went and fought under General O'Duffy. They didn't exactly cover themselves in glory, but to some extent it's not their fault. General Franco was a nationalist, not internationalist, so foreign fighters weren't always welcome with the nationalist army. And so it's very, it's a major contrast to the internationalism of the international brigades. They were there for a while. They fought at a battle during the early part of 1937, but they ended up, unfortunately, getting involved with a fight with people who later turned out to be actually members of their own side. So they were eventually withdrawn. They were withdrawn and returned to the UK. Both Peter Kemp and Frank Thomas fought for most of the war, and Peter Kemp was actually wounded on several occasions. He served with a number of units, including the Foreign Legion, and was clearly very brave, but it was, yeah, very, very much a right, he called himself a right-wing Tory, but really his, yeah, he was an anti-communist.
So we sort of talked about the motivation of people leaving the British Isles, going to serve in Spain. So what happens once they get there? And because I'm quite interested in looking at the dimensions of unit structure and how that might shape motivation once they're in uniform. So how were volunteers organised once they reached the front line? You've touched on obviously the international brigades and that Orwell was serving with the militia. But what was where would I go if I was a average volunteer in 1936? How would the Republican authorities deal with me?
Right, so the usual story would be that if you wanted to volunteer for the war, you would go down to your local Communist Party, you would have a quiet word with somebody, and you'd be pointed in the direction of King Street, the head office of the Communist Party. They would then arrange and they would pay for and arrange transport for you to get out to Spain. Once you arrived, you were taken over the border, most after about the early 1937 when volunteering was illegal. People had to essentially march over the Pyrenees, a tough march for some of these men who were not necessarily fit or experienced at walking and marching. But nevertheless, they would be marched during the night over the Pyrenees to avoid patrols who were trying to prevent people going into Spain. Once they arrived into Spain, they'd be taken down to Figueres in northern Spain, where they'd be put into units based primarily on nationality and language. They'd then be sent to the International Brigade head office in Albacete, and they would then be put into essentially battalions based on nationality. So within the 15th International Brigade, which is the one I know most about, the English-speaking brigade, there would have been an American battalion, a Canadian battalion, a British battalion, and then another. It was originally Yugoslavian, but it was later a Spanish battalion. Because as time went on, there was this feeling that there should be Spaniards in every unit. That it should be very clear that people were fighting alongside Spaniards, not instead of. So there would be a Spanish section within a company, a Spanish company within a battalion, a Spanish battalion within a brigade, etc., etc., etc. So the people in the international brigades themselves would be broken down into battalions of nationality, and then a normal military structure would exist. Although they were known as brigadas mixtas, so they tended to be autonomous. So each brigade would come with all of its support, whether so machine guns, transport, artillery, rather than being broken down into separate brigades. Having said that, alongside equally important alongside the military command, there was also a political structure of political commissars. So there'll be that was brigade, battalion, company. They would all have political commissars. Now, this is often understood, misunderstood, and I can understand why, because it does give the feeling of the kind of Red Army. And of course, it was like that. One of the job of the commissars was to very much put across propaganda. To make the volunteers understand what they were fighting for, and to keep an eye on those, to keep make sure that there was no political dissenters, because it was, there was a paranoia about Trotskyism, there was a paranoia about infiltration. So the political commissars were very much there to keep everybody in line. But having said that, it's also important to recognise that, and a lot of brigaders stress this, even those who weren't necessarily ardent communists, that the commissars very much acted like I suppose like a chaplain in the British Army, there to provide support, somebody to turn to when things were getting bad, which of course they did on many, many occasions. So so there's two structures really, a traditional military structure on one side and a political structure running alongside it. And there were tensions, there's no doubt about that, and some political commissars saw their role as surrogate political officers, which wasn't really what they were supposed to do. But it was complicated by the fact that some political commissars went on to become military leaders. So it was slightly blurred. So, in some respects, it's not a great surprise that there was misunderstandings and conflict. But on other occasions, the most famous being the last commander and commissar of the British Battalion, Sam Wiles and Bob Cooney, and they were essentially mates. So they managed to work very effectively and support each other when needed, which is, yeah. But it didn't always work like that, but quite often that was the case.
I don't know what that strange image was that came up on my screen. Anyway, so did actually being, I suppose, deployed with fellow countrymen, British, American, etc., help build unit cohesion, unit loyalty, mutual solidarity? And did that help motivate soldiers to fight?
Well, that's an interesting question. They were certainly the fact that they all spoke the same language and they were all very much from a similar culture, whether they were from Wales or Scotland or Northern Ireland. So, yes, of course, it did. But I think probably just as important was the political cohesion, because the thing that really united them is that they all knew what they were there for. They all believed that they were there, they were fighting fascism, and that they were really trying to fight fascism in Spain so they wouldn't have to fight it in the UK. And I think that was the main driver. But of course, it's, as you will know better than anybody, it's an old trope that soldiers fight for the person standing next to them. So of course, absolutely, people develop friendships in conflict, which have a kind of strength to them that for many people sustains them for the rest of their lives. So absolutely, that was an important thing. Friends fought for each other. They supported each other. You know, they would take risks for friends that they might not take for anybody else. So, you know, like anything else, there's a kind of greater understanding that everybody's fighting for this cause. But then when you come actually into battle and you're being bombed and planes are dropping bombs on you and you're in a trench with two people on either side of you, it becomes a very much a personal thing. And it's really about, you know, just saving your own skin and everybody else's. And with the confusion and the, you know, I know it's a cliche, the fog of war, at this stage, we've got, you know, we've got no radios, we've got no real communications, the telephones hardly any worked. So they're dependent on runners. So most of the time when they're actually in the heat of combat, nobody really knew what was going on overall. They had no kind of greater strategic idea. So they were just trying to fight themselves and for their mates.
And did any of them reflect on the experience of combat? And did that sort of, I suppose, sharpen their commitment to the cause? Or did the horror of the war they saw actually have caused significant sort of questions about the what they're fighting for and why they're there?
Well, I think amongst those who were committed, who were really deeply committed, I don't think anything changed. But certainly there were many, many volunteers who were utterly shocked by their experiences of fighting in Spain. I mean, I imagine combat is, I've never been in combat, but I'm sure that for anybody that has, it's an utterly shocking experience at the best of times when you're well equipped, you're well rested, you've got plenty of people around you. But the majority of the time in Spain, particularly in the early days in 1937, they had old weaponry, mixed ammunition, some of which wasn't for the guns that they had. Nobody really knew what they were doing. They had nobody was ever given any information about digging trenches or how to avoid shelling, about lying down even. So it's not surprising that quite a few people realized very early on that this was not for them, and there was quite a high degree of desertions. Utterly understandable, I think, really. Because of course, you know, if you're in the First World War and you desert, it's really difficult, because where are you going to go? You can't go back to your family because you're going to be picked up. So it's very difficult to see where you can run to. But for the volunteers in Spain, they were volunteers, of course. I mean, it may be true that you can volunteer in, but you can't volunteer out. But lots of people decided that they couldn't stand it, and returned home. And while they might have, had other people being critical of them and all the rest of it, they could return home to their family and they could live a safe life, well, at least until 1939, of course.
Which is a nice segue into my next question is, was there significant support for the British volunteer effort from the communities from which they came? And if so, did this support really encourage volunteers to keep fighting?
The answer to the first question is very straightforward. Yes, there was. There were huge campaigns. There have been arguments among historians about the extent of it, whether you could legitimately call it a nationwide Aid for Spain campaign. But in a way, that for the volunteers, that didn't really matter because they lived within a political culture where pretty much everybody was on board, and they knew from their friends and their family and members of the party, and from reading copies of the Daily Worker or the News Chronicle or even the Manchester Guardian, that there was widespread support for them in the UK. And Clement Attlee, of course, came out and visited them in December 1937. So it was, Harry Pollitt, the leader of the Communist Party, is probably not surprised that he came out on five occasions. But it was very clear to those people fighting in Spain that, yeah, that they did have the support of the people at home. Sorry, there was a second part. Remind me the second part.
It was whether that support helped them keep going.
I would think that the level of support certainly made people feel. Yeah, I would think that it would have helped, but of course it would be difficult for them really to know how much of that was the case because they're reading newspapers which most will have been aware that will have been, if not absolute propaganda, certainly putting across a line. And it was difficult. The postal service was notoriously bad getting to Spain, so the news from home was not always good. But where it did arrive, it was supportive. There were a few occasions when people wrote to Spain asking for brigaders to come home, either because they were young kids and shouldn't have been out there, or because they were the parents of children who also shouldn't have been out there. So that did happen. But I think in the main, the fact that they knew that they had a body of support back home would have acted as a kind of bulwark for sure.
One thing I suppose I should have reflected on earlier, was it technically illegal for British citizens to fight for a foreign power in the way that the international brigaders did? I'm thinking about it was an 1870 Act which was passed, and it was meant that people from Britain couldn't volunteer for other countries' armies. But I don't know whether that was true or whether that's just my ill reading of the evidence. But I wonder whether if that was a factor, did that motivate some people to remain at home?
Yeah, there was certainly the case that some people didn't go, and I've read interviews with people who were put off from going, or at least they said it was because it was illegal. They decided not to go. But the application of the 1870 Foreign Enlistment Act was always tricky. The government did ban volunteering to go to Spain, but nobody was ever prosecuted. And in general, what would happen is brigaders would be hassled at the border by members of Special Branch. But of course, at one level, Special Branch were absolutely happy to see loads of communists head off to Spain and not come back. So it's complicated. But there were three real problems with the Foreign Enlistment Act. The first is that it was originally designed. It said it talks about states, so it's about wars between foreign states, which of course Spain wasn't at any point, so it didn't really count. So there was an understanding that legally it may not be possible to enforce it. There was also the problem that the Labour Party, the trade unions, and a large body of British public opinion actually supported the Spanish Republic and supported the volunteers who went out there. So that any prosecutions would have been bitterly opposed. And then the third problem was really a practical one, in that most of the volunteers who went, particularly after about October and November 1936, when they didn't have a passport, so they had a return ticket to Paris, nicknamed a you know, dirty weekend ticket to Paris. So they all went out on these tickets. So when they were questioned by Special Branch, despite the fact that they were obviously going to Spain, they would all deny it and say, "Oh no, no, we're just going to Paris. Yeah, we'll be back on Monday. See you on Monday." So it's very difficult for the government to actually prove that these people were going to Spain. And likewise, when they came back, apart from when the whole battalion came back at the end of 1938, if people were coming back in dribs and drabs, they weren't that keen on admitted that they'd been in Spain. So they would just say, "Oh no, I got thrown in jail in Paris, or I got a bit drunk and forgot what happened, and you know, and I'm coming back." So they never really managed to use the 1870 Foreign Enlistment Act because it was just too problematic. So it was technically illegal, but most of the volunteers didn't take it. Well, all the people that went obviously took no notice, and none of them were ever prosecuted. So we're right to do so, I guess.
And another thing I was wondering was how many of the volunteers had combat experience from the First World War, and then did this have any impact on their military morale and their sort of will to fight? I'm thinking that many of them would have been in their mid-30s, maybe a little bit older, but whether that was obviously a significant factor for some.
The majority of volunteers who went were, the average age was about 29. So there weren't that many who had fought in the First World War. There were a few, and that was obviously useful. We don't actually have a great deal of evidence on the extent of military experience. Going through all the files that were put together at 1938, we get there's about 600 of them, and about 300 of those did say they had some level of military experience, but that could differ wildly. A lot of it was they'd served in the territorials, or they'd been, if they were slightly better off, they'd served in the OTC at school. But even in that case, those who had got some experience, a lot of it was inappropriate. I mean, there's one who'd been in the British Army, but essentially he was a trumpeter, and you know, so he might have done his basic service, but being able to play the trumpet is not necessarily a useful preparation for fighting against Franco's Moroccan Foreign Legion. So there's been a recent book that's very critical about the military prowess of the international brigades. And I think that's a fair criticism. There was lots of propaganda at the time talking about how the brave international brigades had saved Madrid, how the Spanish Republic relied upon them. That's definitely overstating the value of the international brigades. But they were, particularly at first, though they were not very good, they were better than a lot of the militia units. You've got to remember that by the end of 1936, essentially Franco's just cut swathes through Spain, brushing aside any defence all the way up to Madrid. And it was only at Madrid, it was the first time really that the Francoist forces were actually held. Now, I'm not for a minute saying that it was the international brigades that did that. It was a combination of Spanish forces, local population, militia, anarchists, and the international brigades. But what the international brigades really gave at that stage, which was crucial, was the notion that the Spanish people were not alone. It was not just that their fight, that they were supported from around the world. So they brought some military experience, particularly the Germans and some of the Eastern Europeans. But they brought, as I say, this notion that the Spanish Republic was also supported by people around the world. And I think that made a huge difference, huge difference.
And to complete our story, what became of the international volunteers after the war? You've mentioned that some of the battalions were brought back in late 1938, and I think this might be the focus of your latest research project thing. But what really came back? How many didn't come back? And are there any sort of famous stories of people whose experience really dominated their life? Obviously, maybe Orwell and Hemingway might well come into that category.
Of the Brits who went, about 20% didn't come back. Over 520 were killed in Spain. So a very high proportion of those who went to Spain were killed. After they returned, there was obviously a lot of people drifted back over various stages in the war because they'd served in a period of time, or because they'd been injured, or because they were recalled. But the majority, the rump of the battalion, returned at the end of 1938. And then after that brief kind of interregnum before the Second World War, once the war broke out, there was a kind of, it depended. Particularly within the Communist Party, there's a big debate about this because at first, when the war broke out, the feeling was very much that this was a continuation of the war in Spain. It was anti-fascist. And lots of people, including the leader of the Communist Party, Harry Pollitt, supported carrying on the fight. But there were orders came down from the Soviet Union, from Stalin, that in fact this was an imperialist war, not an anti-fascist war. So at that stage, loyal communists refused to fight and actually opposed the war. This all changed in June 1941, of course, when the Soviet Union was invaded. But up till that point, they opposed the war as an imperialist war. Not everybody agreed with that, it's fair to say. And a lot of people who'd fought in Spain saw themselves as anti-fascist first and communist second, and either drifted away from the party or just ignored the orders from above and signed up anyway. And lots joined up at the start of the war. Though it was tricky because the British government, or the British Army, the Ministry of Defence, the War Office, had issued a decree saying that international brigaders, particularly those who'd come back at the 1938, would not actually be welcome in the armed forces, particularly if they were communists and seen as political activists. So some people volunteered for the war and were told that they couldn't serve. This is particularly the case in 1939 and early 1940. And that situation changes. I think there's been research done recently which suggests that obviously attitudes changed in 1941, but British government attitudes changed with the fall of France, really, and the realization that actually we were going to be, if not standing alone, but that was how it was portrayed, and that very much it was a question of all backs to the wall, and that we would need everybody. And some people who weren't able to get in 1939 then served. But there were others, like Sam Wilde, who was the last commander of the British Battalion in Spain. He tried to volunteer in all sorts of things, including the Home Guard, and he was knocked back at every stage, and he was refused to accept him into any regiment at all. So it's a mixed story from both sides, really.
And my final question is, where can people get much more information on this, and where can they get your books from?
Well, there's all sorts of places that they can get information. Obviously, there have been a number of books written over the years about the British Volunteers. Some of the earlier ones are now out of print, but My Unlikely Warriors is, I think, available in normal bookshops, and the latest one, Forged in Spain, likewise. But there's also lots of information on the web. There are huge archives in London in the Marks Moran Library. The documents that were sent away from Spain to Moscow are now online. Those are easily accessible online and have got massive information. There's probably there's the well there are memorials across the UK, particularly the big one in London when there's an annual gathering in July. But the kind of main nexus for any of this, of anybody who wants to know more, is the International Brigade Memorial Trust. And they have a website, and they're an organisation whose job really is to put out information about the volunteers in Spain, and they do this with lectures and commemorations and helping to raise monuments. And as I say, they're very present on social media and on the web. So there's plenty of places that people can find out more.
Richard, thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome.